Now, a little bit of England surrounded by China, an exclusive interview with longtime Hong Kong-based journalist David O'Rear.
I'm David O'Rear. I lived in Hong Kong for 31 years. Now I live in London. And my position was in policy research and economic analysis. I worked for the Economist Group. I worked for the General Chamber of Commerce. Really, what we were doing was trying to lobby the government to do more that would enhance the livability and attraction of Hong Kong as a place to work and run a company.
Give us a timescale here, because there's been the big change in 97.
Yeah, I came in 84, and everybody was always saying, what's going to happen after 1997? So after 13 years of that, we finally didn't have to answer that question anymore. And the next morning, we woke up and found out the Thai baht had collapsed, and the entire Asian financial crisis began. So we went through 7 years of depression in Hong Kong, mainly because the currency was pegged to the U.S. dollar. While everybody else was devaluing, our prices fell. So over 7 years, we had 20% deflation, and property prices fell by about 70%. So in that time period, I was then working as chief economist at the General Chamber of Commerce, which is the largest and oldest chamber in Hong Kong, and we were trying to devise ways to alleviate the pain that was being felt. We had very high unemployment, massive budget deficits, and so forth, and through some of our ideas and some from other organizations and government itself, we came up with some policies that put Hong Kong on a recovery track. And we then had about 7 years of good times. And then we ran into the North Atlantic financial crisis, which wasn't a financial crisis in this part of the world, except for the fact that global trade collapsed, and trade is what drives Asia.
Now, the 50 years was supposedly the deal in 97. How's that working out? Because this is a bit of a trust involved here with the Beijing government in that they're really going to leave Hong Kong for 50 years before they start really intervening.
Well, the whole idea is an experiment. Nobody's ever seen a large communist country take over a small capitalist enclave and keep it capitalist. Then you have the entire change of leadership from the British to local Chinese. And they didn't really understand how much autonomy Beijing was willing to give them. Beijing didn't understand that Hong Kong people really don't want to do anything to disrupt China. There's always a few hotheads. And so there's a mutual mistrust. So the first chief executive, Tung Chee Hwa, was trying to establish that groundwork, the framework for moving forward. And so he was extremely cautious about dealing with Beijing and also about doing anything that might upset the Hong Kong business environment, because in this time of the Asian financial crisis, there was a great fear of capital flight.
Now, you talk about China as communist. A lot of people now see it more as leaning towards capitalists. It's actually become more successful in many ways than the United States on the world trade scene.
Well, certainly they've moved a long ways away from traditional communism. It's much more nationalistic, but still quite authoritarian. And so that's where you get into some conflict with Hong Kong, because Hong Kong is a freewheeling, open city, free press, free capital flows, legal system that's based on the British principles. And so to have political parties that challenge the government was not something that China was comfortable with. To having a court system that could challenge the government was not something they're comfortable with. So we're trying to work out between the advantages of Hong Kong and the sovereignty of China how the government could move forward on some various policy issues. And I think the real problem came when they began to cater more to Beijing's interests than to those of the Hong Kong people.
Now, looking at the news stories just over the last few weeks, we've seen individuals barred from standing in the Legislative Assembly. Also, one I was noticing just the other day, some Hong Kong bookseller, when he's ventured out of the city, he finds himself in mainland China, arrested on the train and dragged in by the police. So you do wonder whether this is ever can ever really work, to have these two legal jurisdictions almost kind of overlapping.
Well, one of the major issues is that China does not want Hong Kong to be any kind of a base of subversion. That's one of their great fears. They are willing to allow Hong Kong to have elections and a type of democracy, but they don't want it spilling over into China. with cross-border communications and internet and television and radio and all that, it's easy for Hong Kong ideas to filter into China. But what was happening with the booksellers, and this man and some others had actually been kidnapped and returned to China previously, is that they were printing books that were telling scandals and thinly supported stories about the top leadership in China.
Okay, now it sounds to me like you're talking about a version of Private Eye.
It was, in the sense, it was pretty thinly based on fact. But what was really annoying the Chinese leadership was, first, they were being printed in simplified Chinese characters, which are read on the mainland and not necessarily in Hong Kong, the more complex ones we use here. But they were a great tourist draw. So the mainland tourists were coming in and buying up these books and taking them back across. So somebody in China, whether it was Public Security Bureau or some other organization, decided to teach these guys a lesson and came into Hong Kong and took some of them out. This fellow, who is Swedish-Chinese, recently arrested, was actually kidnapped in Thailand. So this is a real question for Hong Kong about, can we protect our own people, particularly inside our borders? And do the authorities in China have the right to come in and interfere in local affairs? And according to the basic law, they don't.
They're waiting for people to sort of leave and then grabbing them then. Is that the idea? I mean, it also does suggest, doesn't it, either that the West is somehow trying to use Hong Kong to spread scandals about the Chinese government, but it may just be simply the idea of having a free press is absolutely not going to happen as far as the Chinese are concerned. So whereabouts on that line do you think is the reality of it?
I think it would be a mistake to attribute any of this to the West. This is Hong Kong generated, Hong Kong grown. The mainland authorities like to say it's foreign interference stirring up trouble in Hong Kong, but that's just a bunch of nonsense. This is Hong Kong people unhappy with Hong Kong government, and by the way, not very happy with the authoritarian regime in China, and expressing their views. What happens with the booksellers is they were illegally taken out of Hong Kong against their will. In this particular case, most recently, the man appears to have been traveling in China on his own with the permission of the Chinese government, and then somebody made a decision that he wasn't going to be allowed to remain free. But he was in China, and so he's in their jurisdiction.
Okay, what about the Legislative Assembly? Can you just explain a bit about that? Because as I understand it, it's not actually a majority of democratically elected people making decisions anyway.
Yeah, so the legislature is a very odd one. Half the seats are elected by geographies, which is what everybody knows is an election. Half of them are elected by what are called functional constituencies. So the labor unions have seats, and the teachers have seats, and the accountants, and the business community, and the bankers, and the insurance companies, and various functional groups are allocated one or more seats that they, within their group, elect. So tens of thousands of teachers elect the teacher representative, the educator. Tens of thousands of accountants elect the accounting representative. Now, there are districts, geographic districts, that are smaller than that. So we have to be careful about saying they're not democratically elected. If you're looking at total number of votes, some of the functional representatives get more votes than some of the geographic ones. But there is some area within the legal process where you have to have a majority of both types of legislators in order to pass something. For example, amending the basic law or making some other major changes to legislation here. The executive branch is far more powerful than in most countries, and they are the ones that are allowed to initiate legislation. If a private member, as they call them, tries to initiate legislation, he has to get permission from the executive branch. So there's a very, very strong control coming from the executive. And then the legal system is a British-style system that, on paper and 98% in practice, is just like a Western legal system. It operates independently. It makes its own decisions. There is a small area where there is interference on political grounds, and that tends to be when someone is challenging the government or challenging a business or political entity in China.
What about the character of mainland China and here in Hong Kong? You've had this British rule here for such a long time. Surely must have made a bit of a difference.
Well, it's very hard to generalize between 7.5 million Hong Kong people and 1.4 billion mainlanders. But in general, you start off with things like the people of Hong Kong are far richer. They've had a long history of being free to speak out, to change their jobs, to immigrate, to lead their lives the way that a modern Western economy would allow them to. In the mainland, you have only recently a majority of people who are urban dwellers and no history of freedom to speak and to organize political parties and labor unions and so forth. So there is a very large divide there. As China has progressed over the last three decades, there's also become a very strong sense of pride in the mainland. Prior to 97, Hong Kong people tended to look at their country cousins as hicks, and they really thought that they were just kind of, you know, a little slow. Well, now the shoe is on the other foot. And the mainlanders are coming down here and saying, you're actually not that wealthy, you know. Have you seen the province I own? And so it's hard for Hong Kong people to accept that mainlanders can be equal or even higher in status than they are. Then you have the great tourism movement. China's been sending millions of tourists overseas, and every single one of them, their first stop is Hong Kong, because we do Chinese tourism light. We have their food, we take their currency, we laugh at their jokes, we speak their language. Every single Chinese tourist that goes abroad first comes to Hong Kong. They aren't necessarily what we would call the most couth people. Some of them are fairly modestly educated and not that well off, and they tend to overwhelm districts or stores in, you know, busloads coming in, acting as they do in the mainland, pushing people aside and trying to get their transaction done first while somebody else may have been there before them. So there is a clash there, and some of the political reaction among the more radical people here has been to harass these tourists. And that certainly doesn't do Hong Kong any good, because tourism is a huge industry here.
What about Christianity and faith? We've seen this in Russia when the communists took over in Russia, demolishing the great cathedral in Moscow. Similar sorts of attitudes by the communists since the revolution in mainland China. Do you think that there is a future for the faiths, Christian faith particularly? Well, I noticed there are sort of colonial churches and things like that around Hong Kong, which you wouldn't see in mainland China.
In the first 50 years, there was a pretty serious crackdown on religion, because it was seen as a competing organization that could challenge the Communist Party. And that is, you know, something they had to worry about. If you look at the history of the Catholic Church in Latin America, for example, liberation theology and so forth. But in the last 25 years, I would say, there's been a great easing. And now there are increasing numbers of people in the mainland who can express their faith, whether it's Christianity or Islam, Buddhism or Taoism. And it is something that is, I think, unrelated to the problems between Hong Kong and the mainland, or between the mainland visitors and the Hong Kong people.
What about the Middle East? Because this is a center of tension right around the world. The Chinese have said that they think East Jerusalem should be the capital of Palestine. And now we've got, on the opposite side, Donald Trump saying, actually, Jerusalem should be Jewish. You know, the Israeli government should be running things there. So you've got an inevitable tension coming along down the track somewhere. What do you make of that?
Well, I'm not an expert on the Middle East. I would kind of question why either one of those two governments that you mentioned should be involved in trying to decide the future of a place like Jerusalem. China's main concern with the Middle East is that the westernmost area, Xinjiang, is predominantly Muslim. And just across the border in places like Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, a little further away, there are people who are the same ethnic makeup, Turkish makeup, and the same religion, and there is a concern in China that there will be cross-border stimulation of terrorism or separatism efforts, and so they're very concerned about that. And they're beginning to do a lot more work with Afghanistan and Pakistan in order to try and head off that potential.
We've had the announcement recently about this President Xi speak, the idea that laughing at the national anthem could be imprisonable offence of up to 3 years on the mainland. Criticism of the president also potentially criminal. I mean, this is normal in the West, and yet it's becoming criminal in China. What's the future for Hong Kong along those lines? And does Hong Kong have the same penalties as mainland China? Whether you're criticising the state, you know, you can be in jail for it, effectively. It's almost asking for a whole kind of new generation of political prisoners in Hong Kong.
The East Asian model is highly hierarchical. So you are expected to show deference and respect to those in high office. People who try to slander the Prime Minister of Singapore, for example, regularly are brought into court. And the more sophisticated technique there is to bankrupt them. So then they're ineligible to run for office, and you effectively drive them out of the political structure. China doesn't do subtle, so they've passed their laws, and Hong Kong is expected to support the national agenda. And this is where it gets a little tense, because things like the national anthem, in many countries, if you don't show respect for the national anthem, you may not be arrested, but somebody might punch your lights out. So this is a provocative thing that shouldn't be provocative. There was a program to educate people about China, and this is curiously something that has not been on the education agenda. If you only went through the school system here up until, say, the 1980s, and never looked at anything else, you might really not know much about China after the revolution. That's when education on China stopped. You just weren't taught anything more because it was so controversial. What they need here is some understanding of how China works, what is possible, what is not possible. That came under the term national education, and there was a huge protest against it, and it was postponed. In my education in California, it was called civics, and it was not controversial at all. It was telling you about the origins of our great country and your responsibility as a citizen, your duties, and things like that. When you have a free society and a less free society that are suddenly thrust together, that becomes highly controversial. So many people here, particularly the ones who are advocating separatism, independence, or are called localists, have no idea how China works, what the political structure is like, what is possible, what is not possible. And so when they bring up these notions that are completely at odds with the core principles of the Chinese Communist Party, they're going to get stepped on. They know it, and they also know that they're not going to achieve any of their goals. But as they have told me, we're trying to get attention. We can't get any attention any other way. Well, one way of saying that is you couldn't get elected. You couldn't get enough votes, so you're doing these other things to stir up trouble. Well, that happens in the West, and we react kind of the same way. You couldn't get elected. Go campaign a little harder. Try and make your policy positions a little more acceptable. But if you stir up trouble, you're going to get put in your place.
The umbrella protests, they were accused very quickly by China of being instigated by the West. Have we seen the end of those, and was there any truth to that accusation?
As far as I know, there's absolutely no truth to it. There was no need for the West to be involved in anything. This was a domestically grown affair, and it was arising out of a very stubborn position by what are known as the pan-democrats, of a collection of pro-democracy political parties and individuals, who wanted a fully elected legislature, none of these functional constituency seats, and they wanted a directly elected chief executive, the title head of the government of Hong Kong, and they wanted anybody to be allowed to run for any of those seats. That was their position. They were offered a transition deal where there would be a steady progress towards those ideals. They rejected it. As a result, we got no progress whatsoever. So politics is the art of compromise. You stake out your position, and then you see what's possible. And if you can't find a common ground, you end up deadlocked, like the U.S. Congress, or you end up forced to go one way or the other by whoever's got the most votes. Now, it's very important to understand that in the legislature, in these functional constituencies, there is no limit on who can run, except you've got to be one of those people. You've got to be a teacher. You've got to be an accountant. You've got to be part of that group. And some Democrats do try and run in those seats, and they tend not to get elected. So they're going to have to appeal to the voters more directly. And that's difficult because there is a general conservative nature in Hong Kong that doesn't want to see trouble, doesn't want to see change, at least not dramatic change. You'd like to see, you know, directly elected legislature, like to see a directly elected chief executive, but not if it's going to cause trouble. So they can't get the popular support, and therefore they're looking for other means. Now, the protest at Occupy Central in 2014 paralyzed portions of the city and dragged on for 3 months, partly as a government tactic to wear them down and not have to go in with force. The force that was used, some tear gas and some pepper spray, was minimal when you put it up against, you know, somebody with an iron bar beating on a policeman. You know, you're going to get a reaction. Any country in the world, if you beat on a policeman, you're going to get a reaction. And the reaction they got here was quite muted and quite proportional. But we have this societal issue that has to be addressed. There's a very tight housing arrangement here. People are packed into the densest population of any major city I can think of. And so when you have suddenly thousands of people sitting on the streets camping out, well, yeah, this is fun. Let's go out and camp. And I'll tell you a side story. One of the convenience store operators here, a chain store, I asked him how his business was doing. I thought it might be disrupted by this. And he said, oh, we're doing a tremendous business selling cigarettes and condoms. So there were people who were out there having a good time and wanting to continue having that good time. For the first time, they weren't living at home with grandma and the parents and little sisters and brothers and constantly being watched and never having their own place. And now they had their tent, and they could maybe have a girlfriend over and, you know, be independent for a little while. It was quite entertaining, and it was quite sort of a commune kind of an environment. But to say that it was, you know, a serious political movement to try and achieve some practical goals, yeah, that was the start of it. But it quickly deteriorated into something that was just, it was a protest for the sake of protesting in some ways.
The next generation are the ones who are going to have to face the end of this 50 years. Do you think they're prepared for it? Are they ready for it?
I don't think anyone can be prepared. We don't know what's going to happen. Now, I've done a lot of forecasting in my profession, and if you're going to forecast out now, say, 30 years, you're going to have to go back 30 years and see how much change there might be. 30 years ago, China was closed. Not 100%. They're beginning their liberation, liberalization movement. But you had none of this free enterprise and massive trade presence in the world, and the world's largest foreign exchange reserves and millions of tourists going overseas. So the magnitude of change in the next 30 years is going to be the key factor as to how Hong Kong and China continue in their relationship. I think it's far too early to decide on this, but there are issues that need to be addressed. For example, ownership. Mortgages do extend beyond 30 years sometimes, and you've got to have the guarantee that that's still going to be honored. Now, what is in the basic law is that for the first 50 years, that is until July 1, 2047, Hong Kong cannot be socialist. It cannot be communist. It must have its own currency. It must have a low-tax environment. It must have a broadly balanced budget. It must have its own legal system. There is nothing in the basic law that says, and on that date after, it all changes. So nothing actually has to change. But one would expect that something might change. We don't know what that's going to be. It's too early. But there is no hard and fast reason why there has to be a change. And we're going to see so much change in China over the next 30 years that it's almost impossible to estimate what their key requirements will be in 2047.
Maybe China might itself be changing more to look like Hong Kong in that time.
That's what we thought 20 years ago. In some ways, they have changed to be more like Hong Kong. For example, tourism and trade and foreign investment, information being readily available from government ministries. These things have changed dramatically in the last 20 years. If it continues on the same trajectory, then we could have quite a bright future for Hong Kong. The problem is that Hong Kong leaders don't have the backbone to stand up to Beijing and say, wait a minute, we understand the national agenda. We have our own local agenda, and we need to pursue that, because otherwise Hong Kong is going to be ungovernable. You need to stand back and let us do our job. And as long as we don't undermine the sovereignty of the state or embarrass you or otherwise do something that is seriously wrong, just let us get on with it, because that's what the deal was when we started.
That's David O'Rear there, worked for something like 15 years for The Economist, and then was the chief economist at the Hong Kong Chamber of Commerce. Martin, he seems to be saying there that Hong Kong people have got their fingers crossed, hoping that China will leave them alone.
Well, I mean, I listened with interest to everything that he said there. But the Chinese economy has come from virtually nowhere in international terms to being dominant. And long before the 50 years are up, the Chinese economy were the biggest economy on the planet. There's no doubt about that, unless there's a nuclear war or something of that sort, which, of course, can't be ruled out, given the maniacs that are in charge. So...
What's your view on, we talked there about, for example, the arrest of publishers, radical publishers? I mean, he's saying there's a completely different setup with the legal system completely welded in with the Communist Party over in mainland China, and that the idea of publishing scandals about people at the top of the Communist Party is simply not going to run in mainland China at all. Whereas it's, you know, for years and years, they've had criticism of the leadership over in Hong Kong. It's almost like two worlds about to collide.
Yeah, but I mean, you're focusing as a radical journalist on people publishing scurrilous...
Well, it's very important.
It's very important.
The freedom of the press, Martin, is quite crucial
right,
here.
I'm not disputing that, Tony, but underlying all of this is economics and bread and butter stuff. I mean, the Chinese Communist Party supporting mainland China is because they've changed direction to a more... capitalist road, if you like, and they've massively increased people's living standards, and they've got loyalty from the people as a result of that.
But if
and of
taking,
course,
if
therefore,
taking,
the quid pro quo for that is don't rock the boat.
I mean, over here, we know that some of our leaders are taking bribes and bungs, and in the financial sector, they're corrupt. Over in China, if you start to say that sort of thing, like we're saying on here, you just go to jail, simple as that.
Well, apart from the fact that Xi Jinping has sent thousands of his lower level cadres to prison for exactly that. The Communist Party line is, if you are corrupt, we will take care of it. And they're actually quite...
So there's no corruption at the top of the Communist Party?
I didn't say there was no corruption. I just said there's a struggle against corruption in China and elsewhere. And of course, societies which don't struggle against corruption, like allowing the City of London to run this country, ultimately fail.
Now,
I
don't know how often you pick up Forbes Asia, but I got a copy on the plane, which is quite... It's the world's billionaires. Would you say there's more billionaires in Europe, Asia Pacific, or the United States?
Asia Pacific.
Well, you're absolutely right. They're more than anywhere else on Earth. 827 billionaires in total, about $3 trillion worth. So see you next week. God bless, and don't get the banksters get you down.
Supermarket in the town of Treb. The attacker was shot dead. France's Interior Minister Gérard Collomb says they know who he was.
The terrorist was called Redouine Lakhdine. He was 26 years old and was a known petty criminal. But he was under surveillance and it wasn't thought he'd been radicalised.
Jeremy Corbyn has sacked Owen Smith from the Shadow Cabinet after he repeatedly called for a second EU referendum. He's been replaced as Shadow Northern Ireland Secretary by Tony Lloyd. The teenager convicted of the Parsons Green tube bombing in West London in September has been sentenced to at least 34 years in prison. The court heard the Iraqi asylum seeker had a deep-seated hatred of Britain. The parents of a detective...